Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 13th of April. We're just delighted to have David Remnick with us this hour of the program, author of The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. Received a lot of attention, New York Times book review section, front page story, and a very good review. It's hard to imagine how this guy could go wrong because he's a great writer, and he's got a phenomenally interesting subject, and he does the subject justice. David was a reporter for the Washington Post for 10 years. He had 4 years in Moscow. He joined the New Yorker as a writer in 1992. He's been the magazine's editor since 1998. His last book was King of the World, a biography of Muhammad Ali, which was selected by Time as the top nonfiction book of 1998. He also won a Pulitzer Prize in 1994 for Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire. We'll be welcoming phone calls. This book looks, it doesn't look at the presidency. There are a few sentences or pages about the presidency at the end of the book, but it starts with his, it goes back to his grandparents on his father's side, and we know more, I think, about grandparents on his mother's side, his years in school, what he thought about, his incredible world background. It just still dumbfounds me that he's got, you know, he is a citizen of the world in so many regards, who his influences were, his discovering his identity as a teenager, what he was like as a student, his community organizing. The book begins with the speech in Selma. And it talks about the campaign and his wife in Chicago, and it is a big book. We'll be welcoming phone calls for David at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join this conversation. Talk at WPR.org is also another way for you to get a hold of us. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm great. How are you?
I'm wonderful.
I love the book.
I'm thrilled at
it. Yeah, it must have been something to write this. And the more I read about him, particularly reading your book about this guy, it's just his life is so extraordinary. He even caught the attention of Bob Dylan, right, who doesn't get involved in politics usually, who said, it's an amazing life.
Yeah, Bob Dylan, I don't think has checked in on a presidential campaign in some time. He usually is pretty aloof from these things. But he read the autobiography, Dreams from My Father, and I think he found a kindred soul in one sense. There can be no more self-created figure in American pop culture than Bob Dylan. I mean, a kind of Jewish guy from the Iron Range of Minnesota who all of a sudden starts talking like Woody Guthrie and Allen Ginsberg and just plucks the influences out of the air and creates himself. And I think that Obama's not completely dissimilar. Here's somebody right. That comes from Honolulu and has to go out and find an identity for himself as well as a politics and a community. So there's this moment where Dylan talks about Barack Obama. It was an interview that he gave in England sometime.
Interesting. Let's talk just a little bit. I didn't think I would start here, except that the news of the week is concerning loose nuclear weapons and this amazing summit. It was interesting to me in reading your book to know that Barack Obama thought about these issues of the Cold War, nuclear buildup, et cetera. He used to sit around and talk about that with friends in college.
Yeah, he wrote an article for a school paper when he was at Columbia called The Sundial. And it was about the nuclear freeze movement. It wasn't the wisest or most incisive article. It was a real student article. But he was thinking about these things, and when he was at Columbia and studying international relations, it was really in the thick of the Reagan years when arms control issues were very complicated and very much in the center of political debate.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his father for a bit. You spend quite a bit of time early in the book talking about his father's background, his father coming to the United States, and the president, the now president, mentioning it, I believe, in that speech in Selma, that it was because of this airlift and the Kennedys that was where he was, which wasn't exactly on the mark. But
well,
it's a very interesting story.
Sure. What happened was Kenya threw the Brits out. There was and in post-colonial Kenya, you needed an educated, ruling class. You needed people to run the government, to run bureaucracies, to run important businesses, and yet there was no university in all of Kenya, not one, because the Brits would send their kids abroad, back to England or wherever, and a few African kids who were lucky enough to go to university went to Uganda. There was a neighboring university. So where could they send these kids for a higher education? They created an airlift in 1959, thanks to the initiative of a Kenyan leader named Tom Mboya. And Mboya even enlisted the Kennedy family for some funding for this airlift of students. But it was 1 year after, the Kennedy funding came 1 year after Barack Obama Sr. went to the University of Hawaii. So there was an element, a little bit in that speech, of Obama trying a little too hard to draw a link between his father and the Kennedys and the civil rights era. Maybe a little bit too much poetry and not enough fact-checking, but they apologized for that. But the truth is Obama's father did go on this airlift, ended up at the University of Hawaii, wanted to study economics, and met this very young 17-year-old girl named Stanley Ann Dunham, whose family had moved recently from the Midwest and then on to Seattle and then finally to Hawaii. And they fell in love, and she got pregnant, and they got married secretly and quietly in Maui, one of the islands in Hawaii. And it's a marriage that really didn't last long. It was overcome by Obama Sr.'s ambition and his desire to go to Harvard, and he kind of left this marriage and this child behind.
He left a lot of marriages behind, didn't he?
He did. Over time, he did not prove to be, in any sense, the most constant husband or best father by any stretch of the imagination. And in fact, one of his children, one of his later children, who's now obviously grown and lives in China, said that Obama Sr. even beat his mother, a woman named Mary, an American who moved with Obama to Africa.
Did he beat Anne? Do you know?
There's no evidence whatsoever of that.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't together very long. Not that that proves anything, but there's really no one has said that.
Yeah. I talk about the absence of the father. There's this scene where he comes back to Hawaii. I think
That's
Barack
right.
Obama's 10 years old, and his teacher wants Barack Obama's father to speak in front of the classroom. He hasn't even seen this guy. He's been absent for all of these years, and his father appears. And what Obama's thinking about all of that?
Well, Obama's father was a myth to him. He was a 10-year-old child. His father had disappeared in infancy, when he was an infant, and he came back when Obama was 10 for a 10-day trip, and it was a trip that was extremely confusing to this kid, as well it might be, and his father was asked to speak in front of the class, and he found this very embarrassing, or potentially embarrassing, and because kids there, who were mostly white or Asian, asked weird questions about him, kind of questions about the jungle and all kinds of, stereotypical questions that kids might ask about somebody from Africa if they knew nothing about Africa. And so he was prepared for the worst, but in fact, the father gave a really entertaining and interesting talk, no matter how mortified his son was. But it was a very, very painful trip all in all, because Obama, just imagine a father is out of your life, comes into it for 10 days, seems to have still a relationship with the mother, and then he disappears, never to be seen again. It's an incredibly poignant and painful experience.
Right. And little did he know, which is so amazing to me about this, that he was forsaking the future president of the United States.
Well, Obama Sr. thought that he was going to be on top of the political heap in Kenya.
Right.
And that was the source of his deep frustration, a sense of failure. His career really went awry. It founded on the rocks of tribalism and political rivalries and his own personal behavior, which became increasingly erratic. Not only was he did he have an erratic personal life, but he began to drink more and more and more. And he finally ended up dying in a tragic car accident and really leaving behind a kind of wreckage of his life. And for Obama, Barack Obama, the president of the United States, his own father became not an example but a counterexample,
yes.
Something not to be like.
Right.
An indiscipline and a frustration and a messiness that had to be avoided at all mm-hmm. costs.
It seems to me, David, and tell me who filled this role, if it was his grandparents or who it was, or really his mom at a distance. But here's a guy who doesn't have a father. His mother's in Indonesia and doing a lot of important work on her own, but he's back living in Hawaii with his grandparents. Seems to me as though you need somebody to really believe in you to achieve what he's achieved in his life. Who was it?
Well, I think the mother, in her own eccentric way, and sometimes in her own absent way, was extremely supportive of Obama. In maybe a sentimental way at times, it was clear what she could not provide him. She couldn't provide him with a sense of what it meant to be African American in the United States. And her attempts to, you know, give him Mahalia Jackson records or this book or that book were well-meaning. But Obama, you know, as adolescents can be, you know, kind of looked at his mother on that score as a little bit pathetic. But the mother really adored him. He had a much younger sister. He has a much younger sister with whom he's very close now. But he also, along the way, he brings himself up. He finds mentors in an extremely concerted way. He finds people who can teach him, whether it's in university or law school or community organizing or even in local politics. He has the talent to attract older, generally men, who will instruct him in the ways of the world.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that something, though, that he brings himself up? And he does do that, doesn't he? In lots of different surroundings, where he goes to school.
More than most of us have to, yeah.
Right. Let's talk about this issue of race, because you write a lot about what racial relations were like in Hawaii. We think of that as being, you know, just a paradise in terms of people, everybody being brown, nobody being black or white, or just having this wonderful interaction among all races. It wasn't exactly like that, was it? Tell me about how he experienced his identity in Hawaii.
Well, as the missing piece. In other words, sociologists used to go to Hawaii all the time to examine what some of them thought to be a kind of, as you described it, a kind of racial ideal. But here was the problem. It is part of the United States, and so in the popular culture and in the culture that he's receiving from the mainland, however fragmentary, he realizes that there's a big thing in American life called African American culture, African American political life, and all the rest. And African Americanism is an integral part of what it is to be American. And yet, when he looks around, he's pretty lonely, because most of the African Americans, what few there are in Hawaii and in Honolulu, are on military bases, and he rarely sees those people. So he's in an incredibly fancy private school. Punahou is just as fancy as a private school can be. So it's an elite school, but he's pretty lonely as a black kid. There's only two or three kids on campus that look like he does. In fact, he had a couple of friends that would meet with him once a week on the steps of a particular building, and they would call it Ethnic Corner. These are two other black kids. One of them has grown up to be a doctor now in L.A., and another does religious work. But he had to go out and really pursue this identity in a way that most people don't. Most people have their ethnic identity provided in their families, the kitchen table, at the church or synagogue or wherever. It's there. It's present. They're hearing it. They're seeing it. You don't have to think about it so much sometimes. With Obama, there was an added element of pursuit and self-consciousness.
Right. You also talk about the fact that he went to that prestigious school and to other prestigious schools being as important for us to know about his background as the other parts of life, that coming from elite institutions makes a mark on a person.
Well, Obama, in a speech in Selma in 2007, says we stand on the shoulders of giants. And part of what the giants of the civil rights movement provided for subsequent generations, not everybody, far from everybody, but certainly for the lucky, is access to institutions that African Americans barely had before. So in Obama's case, it's Punahou School, it's Occidental, Columbia, Harvard Law School. He is deeply aware of his access to elite institutions and avenues into politics that were denied. Even somebody like Jesse Jackson. There's no way Jesse Jackson was going to get to Harvard. It would have been a kind of miracle. And Jesse Jackson had a very different political background. He is rooted in the civil rights movement in a way that somebody much younger could not be. but he didn't benefit from the civil rights movement in the same way that a younger man did.
Right. Let's talk a bit about Selma. You just mentioned that, and every time I see John Lewis, actually, I almost break down in tears when I think about what he's been through. It's a fascinating first part of the book, and the quote, "Barack Obama is what comes at the end of that bridge in Selma." Obama introducing himself to major black figures. He's not really a part of the civil rights movement. He's what comes at the end of the bridge in Selma. But he really fashions a beautiful speech, and you write so beautifully about all the history that was involved before that speech that Obama gave.
Well, remember one thing about the metaphor that John Lewis is talking about. The specific bridge in Selma, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, was a battle over voting rights. Voting rights. It's about political life in America. And so what is the ultimate vote for in the U.S. political system? It's for the presidency. So I think we don't want to suggest that by crossing this bridge, this metaphorical bridge, that there's some kind of racial paradise that's been reached, a post-racial America, as the phrase goes. I think that's nonsense, and I think most people recognize that that is an illusion. But it's also an illusion to think that no progress has been made. Actually, quite a lot of progress has been made, but enormous amounts of disparity still exist in American society. So it is a mixed bag.
Right. And isn't it, it wasn't very long ago, you remind us of the horrors of that time, that people, you know, what John Lewis went through, what people went through to achieve some equality. It was a horrendous time in America.
It's unclear to me just how many times John Lewis, who began as a soldier in the civil rights movement for SNCC and later to other groups, how many times he had his head bashed in, how many times he was thrown into jail, how much humiliation and physical abuse can a man endure. And he certainly was not alone. We know this name because he has become a kind of major figure in the history of American, in the history of human rights, essentially. But there were many, many, many people whose names we don't know, both alive and gone, who endured this kind of treatment.
Right. How true. Tell me how important that speech was that Obama gave, and Hillary was there the same day, how they decided who would be able to get what speaking place, and how it was that Obama was able to get people like John Lewis, who had been loyal to the Clintons, to switch.
Well, it was very important for Obama to speak directly to the African-American community. When he announced for the president, he's speaking to the whole country. Remember in Springfield, outdoors,
Oh, yes, I remember it well.
About a month earlier. But then he came to Selma at a very resonant occasion when they're celebrating the anniversary of the march from Selma to Montgomery in 65. And there he speaks directly to a community that is not going to just automatically embrace him because he himself is black. After all, he's running against Hillary Clinton, who both Hillary and Bill Clinton have deep ties to black politicians, but also the community in general. Bill Clinton did fantastically well among black voters, and there was no reason to think that Hillary was going to be radically different. So he had to address that. He just couldn't assume that a state senator and a newly minted, fairly newly minted U.S. senator was just automatically going to get those votes.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to phone calls for you. We have many of them already, and our guest is David Remnick this hour. His book, The Bridge, just released, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. 800-486-8655 is our number. The email address, talk@WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, John Yoo will be with us, author of Crisis and Command. He's a professor of law at UC Berkeley, and he served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel in the U.S. Department of Justice from 2001 to 2003. David Remnick is our guest now. We go to John from Milwaukee for our first call. Hi, John.
Hi. I had heard an interesting thing, and I was wondering if it was true. What I had heard was that the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, actually went to high school in Bangkok, Thailand, and that his father was Barack Obama's mother's boss, that she did microlending in Indonesia, and she reported to Timothy Geithner's father.
That's true.
That's amazing.
That is true. Timothy Geithner's father had a professional relationship with Obama's mother at one time in Asia.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
And the caller is right to raise this about Obama's mother. You know, sometimes the image of her in the campaign was of this kind of flighty 60s batik skirt wearing, you know.
Right. Right.
Woman. She was a very serious woman, and she was involved with political issues. She wasn't a big... She was involved with political issues exactly like the caller mentioned, like micro-lending, like women's rights in the third world. She was involved with the Ford Foundation and many of their projects in Asia. She was pursuing a doctorate in anthropology, concentrating on Indonesian craftsmen. Did not finish writing her quite long dissertation until she was about 50, and finally got her PhD. She was less interested in teaching and being an academic than she was in being a kind of a foundation-based, I wouldn't call it activist, but somebody trying to do good works.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your call, John. We go to Dan from La Crosse. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I remember a quote from Mr. Obama when he was in the campaign. He said that, as I recall, he had walked up the aisle of a church in Chicago, and he said, "I felt I was a sinner and needed to be forgiven by Jesus Christ." That quote does not appear in the book, The Faith of Barack Obama. I wonder if you're familiar with it, and if you'd comment on the
I don't know the exact quote, sir, but there's no doubt that in his autobiography and in interviews that he's given, and what my knowledge is that he sincerely, as a young man, as when he was an organizer, became interested in joining a church and joined, as the world knows now, Jeremiah Wright's church on the South Side, and had a very deep attachment both to him and the church.
You mentioned Dreams of My Father at one point in your book. You say we cannot underestimate the importance of that book in the political rise of Obama.
Yeah, I think that book it certainly doesn't do the work of a biography. It doesn't tell you, honestly, it doesn't tell you what this book is going to tell you. It does a different kind of work. It's a young man's book about identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the formation of a person through the eyes of that person. And it also, at the same time, is very much in a tradition of African-American autobiographical writing that begins with the slave narratives and goes all the way through the many, many examples of this that we know of, whether it's Malcolm X's autobiography or Richard Wright or Maya Angelou, and has some of the structure of those kinds of books where we're pursuing a sense of maybe missing family, a sense of purpose, a sense of self, a sense of liberation, and a sense of a voice. It's a very interesting book in that way. And the book, which was written before he entered politics, became kind of a text that journalists all went to, including myself, and tried to figure out. Remember, he's making his story a cornerstone of his campaign in a way that most politicians don't emphasize. So that book became quite important because it was a real book. It wasn't a kind of, you know, the sort of crummy book that we see for most politicians that seem to be written by committee.
It was a very good book, I thought.
It was. I think it's probably a book that's vastly overrated at this point because for political reasons. A good book is suddenly being, you know, compared to books that are maybe out of its league. But it certainly is an interesting book.
Yeah. Jeremiah Wright, how did he get past that?
How did Obama get past Jeremiah Wright?
Uh-huh.
Well, it was extremely painful. I mean, I think he had to jettison that relationship in order to go forward in his political life. There was just no way after that exploded that he could reliably depend on succeeding politically. And once Jeremiah Wright decided that he would not recede from the political stage, but in fact at the Washington Press Club and elsewhere, was going to be more in everybody's face than he had hoped, then that relationship just ended.
Mm-hmm.
Obama really had to step forward and end it.
Was there a point as a journalist, David, when you thought that might do in the campaign?
Sure. I think we all did, didn't
right.
we? I mean, if he had insisted that everything was right, no pun intended, with their relationship and that he believed the same things that Jeremiah Wright did. There's just really no way that he could have depended on a victory.
Right. There are all these interesting, because he is so much a person of the world in many ways, so many interesting stories about his times in different parts of the world. I was particularly struck, what were his buddies' names? Was it from Columbia or Occidental College, where he went to Pakistan and visited and learned about the Sunni and the Shia?
That's right. He had two Pakistani friends. In fact, he remains pretty friendly with them. Two friends who were either middle, upper middle, or even wealthy kids who had come to Occidental to study abroad. And he was very fast friends with them as a freshman and a sophomore at Occidental, small college, a really good college in near L.A. And at one point, he went to Pakistan with them and stayed with their families. And this was very influential for him.
We're going to just call you back. We'll take a pause here. Whoops, are you there? Yeah, the phone is going. So we're going to pause for just a moment and return. David Remnick is our guest this hour. David is author of The Bridge, just released, critically acclaimed, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can also send an email if you would like, and that address is talk@wpr.org. David is the editor of The New Yorker. He was a reporter for The Washington Post for a number of years, and he's also author of King of the World, a biography of Muhammad Ali, and also Lenin's Tomb. He won a Pulitzer for that, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire. That was awarded in 1994. And I think our phone is better now, and you were telling us the story of his friends and traveling through Pakistan. Please continue, David.
Yeah, the radio gods, I think, attacked us there for a second.
I guess they did for a moment.
It happens.
Yeah.
And what happened was is that he had a couple of well-to-do Pakistani friends at Occidental, and at a certain point he visited them in Pakistan. On a trip, he also visited his mother in Indonesia. And he found that enlightening, as you know, as any young person would, going to somewhere that's not, a Caribbean island or to the beach or something like that. He went somewhere that was utterly other, and he found it fascinating, both the extremes between wealth and poverty, a culture that was entirely different. And it was, you know, this is not unheard of for young people to do that, but it was certainly influential to him. I think the sum total of his travel abroad, his living in Indonesia as a kid, and then his subsequent visits as an older guy, as well as travel elsewhere, certainly had an impact.
Right. He settles in Chicago for a good chunk of time. From a guy who's lived in Hawaii and Indonesia and has this background of so many different parts of the world, I mean, I'm from Chicago as well, so it's kind of nice he picked the Midwest. But talking about a place where you want roots, I say go to Chicago.
He didn't pick it, though. It was an element of luck and happenstance. One day, Barack Obama was in the New York Public Library, one of my favorite places in the world, and he was reading. He's looking for a job. He all his classmates are doing things like, not all of them, but loads of them are going off to investment banks and law school and pretty conventional avenues for graduates of Columbia University and places like it. And he picks up a little newspaper called Community Jobs. And Community Jobs is a place you can find want ads for things like, I don't know, the Peace Corps or kind of do-gooder groups that young people would get some experience, or now you'd say Teach for America, and places like it.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw a little ad, place for a community organizer on the south side of Chicago. And he answered the ad, and he talked to a guy on the telephone named Jerry Kelman, who's an organizer of some experience on the south side, a white organizer in a black neighborhood. And Kelman, who was desperate to get a young black organizer, for obvious reasons, he thought that would be, you know, he would be able to do things that he could not, couldn't tell from the name. And Kelman at that time was married to a Japanese-American woman, and he thought maybe the name was Japanese. Barack Obama, what kind of name is that? And so they agreed to meet in New York. Kelman had family in New York, and they met, and obviously Barack Obama did not turn out to be Japanese-American. And they talked for hours at some coffee shop on Lexington Avenue, and Obama signed on. and he packed his crummy little car, and he drove all the way to Chicago, and he rented a modest apartment in Hyde Park and began working as an organizer. And he found in Chicago everything that he could have hoped to find as a young man, which was a sense of idealism, of serious work, of community, an African-American community. And his job was essentially to interview people, to go around and find out about their lives, find out about what was hard in their lives, find out what they needed. And it was his job to know people of all different kinds of stripes. And that, to him, was an education no less important than, you know, reading books about international relations or history or politics at Occidental and Columbia.
He also found his wife. He found his faith.
That's exactly right. He found his wife once he got to law school. And after the first year of law school at Harvard, where he really starts to get interested in his own and sense of ambition, he had a summer internship at a law firm in Chicago. And he met Michelle Obama. And that story, I think, we all know.
Mm-hmm. There is something about, at a very young age, what you just said, of knowing people of all different stripes and being able to move with a great deal of ease with people from all different stripes. The negative of that is, as people have said about him, that, you know, maybe he loses his own stripes as a result of this, and it was a result of wanting to be embraced by people of all different stripes. What do you
think? I think he knows who he is. I mean, I don't want to dive too deeply into the weeds of psychobiography and therapy and the rest. I really... It makes me, and should make me, uncomfortable in all of us. But I don't get the sense that this guy has any identity problems. In fact, that's what his book is about. It was about solving those things. And by the time he gets to a certain age in his 20s, those issues for him are resolved. It's when he enters politics and political life that they aren't resolved for other people. And he's constantly having to talk about it and explain it and have to answer questions about whether he's black enough or too black or all these kind of crazy questions that still haunt our discussion of race and identity in America.
Yeah. There is this moment. There are so many striking moments about his life. I believe it's when he's rehearsing for giving the acceptance speech in Colorado, and he's with Axelrod and one technician, I think, and he's rehearsing the speech, and mm-hmm. all of a sudden he's remembering Martin Luther King. He kind of gasps.
He's in a hotel room rehearsing. He's going to accept the nomination in Denver. And he gets to a point in the speech on the teleprompter when there's a not-so oblique reference, although he doesn't name the name, of Martin Luther King. And he chokes up. And this is not the Barack Obama we know very often. It's not... Barack Obama does not shed a lot of tears. In fact, a lot of people find him, to a fault, a kind of cool customer when it comes to his self-presentation and even his relations with foreign leaders and others. But he really ran up against the historical import of what was about to happen to him and, by extension, to the country.
Right.
And, you know, it hit him. It hit him hard.
Yeah. Helen from West Salem, hi.
Hi. I have always really appreciated Barack Obama. I think he's a real person. I read his book, Dreams from the Father, and that made me know more about him. And I know he cares for poor people, or why would he get involved with community organizing when he could have taken a big job in a law firm? So this is my question. When a friend of mine said she thought he was the Antichrist, and I thought, where is that coming from? Is that coming from a conservative church, a conservative Republican view, or what?
Who said that?
Or is it racist? I mean, I was just
a friend
stunned
of hers.
And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I can reliably report that your friend is wrong. I think we know where it comes from. It's this political atmosphere that we've lived in for quite some time that gets, in a kind of crazy echo chamber that has, it's a complex system of cable TV and the internet and also very real political anxieties about the economy, and it just sometimes some people can be led to believe absurd things. And whether it's rumors about where Barack Obama was born, or his relations with far-left radicals and how serious or how meaningful they were, it can get crazy out there. And we've all experienced it. We've all seen it. We all see it at the fringes of Tea Party movement. I'm not saying the Tea Party movement is filled with, you know, in its mainstream with pernicious people. Not at all. I think the political argument and dissent and anxiety is all part of, you know, who we are and what we are. Mm-hmm. I may not agree with them, but there it is. But at its extremes, it can get awfully ugly. And those extremes can be exacerbated by political leaders whipping that up into a frenzy.
And were they used? Was race baiting, you write about this later in the book, was race baiting, do you think, I know that Michelle Obama, I believe, thought this, used by the Clinton campaign? Was it used by the McCain campaign?
Well, I think, you know, I spend a lot of time dwelling on this question because it seems to me that in the history of the election of the first African-American president, anybody observing it would want to know, well, how did racial appeals get used or not? Because remember, in the history of American politics, appealing to racial fears has a long, ugly history that goes way back, and it precedes even Reconstruction. Right? I mean, when Ronald Reagan goes to announce a campaign and begins it in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and makes an appeal to states' rights, it does not take a genius to see that he is appealing to some degree and to some people to their racial anxieties.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take a genius to see when George Bush the Elder exploits the issue of a prisoner on furlough as if this was, you know, the central work of Michael Dukakis. It's not hard to see that his campaign is whipping up racial anxiety.
Right.
I think there were certain points when Hillary certainly made comments that were, at best, let's put a euphemism on it, unhelpful. When she talked about how hardworking white people were for her. The fact is that working class whites were voting more for Hillary than they were for Barack Obama, but her language around it was really troubling. Bill Clinton was accused of playing the race card, as the phrase goes, in the wake of the South Carolina primary. I have to say, I think both of those people wanted to win more than anything else. I think their record on race is pretty solid. And I think at the end of the day, in the context of the history of racial appeals, that the Clintons have good reason to argue that that this was really overstated, really overstated. Now, when Sarah Palin gets up at a campaign and starts talking about palling around with terrorists, there you're entering a zone, a twilight zone of real danger, I think.
Let's go to Tom from Appleton. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess a follow-up. I appreciate the subject, and I'm curious as to what you think about, you just mentioned Sarah Palin, but Palin and Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh, they all seem to focus on, or they did at least during the campaign, on Barack Obama's limited experience as an executive. He was a simple community organizer, a part-time senator. You know,
as somebody whose magazine endorsed Obama over McCain, and some critics are seeing the book as too positive, I will surprise you and say it seems to me that when you're a senator for one night, and the next morning people are asking you about running for president, and within 18 months you're pretty much in the thick of a presidential race, I think it's a legitimate question. The experience question is a legitimate question and a legitimate thing to debate. I don't think there's anything wrong with that at all. It's when Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck and others like them did something quite different, which is to hammer away and make racial insinuations that were really deeply troubling.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email from Frank. Are there parallels to Bill Clinton there?
Well, I think ideologically, despite the notions coming from the right that somehow Barack Obama is either a closeted or an open radical, I think a lot of the policy initiatives you're seeing, take health care, are extensions of the history of the Clinton administration or the history of mainstream Democratic Party thinking. That I think Barack Obama is a center-left American politician, period. And I don't think he's a radical. Certainly, if you look at his economic team, you would not get the impression that he's surrounded by the Soviet Central Committee. So, and certainly there's been arguments to his left that on questions of national security, on Afghanistan, on torture, that he has been not nearly what they expected. So I think this is somebody that is a fairly, in the ideological terms, a fairly pragmatic center-left Democratic Party politician.
Scott from Oconto, hi.
Good morning. Yeah, I guess I want to continue with that thought. I mean, you made the point where you think he's center-left. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, one of my issues is I'm not quite sure what he is yet. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't really know his worldview. I mean, I can remember an interview with Tom Brokaw on the Charlie Rose Show where they said, I don't know what he thinks. And Brokaw agreed, I don't know what he reads. I don't know what his beliefs are. And Brokaw was disagreeing. You're right. We don't know much. And I guess, so for me, it's still open.
I try to explore this in The Bridge, this book. And I think to some degree, presidents haven't filled in the picture until they've acted for quite a while. But, and I think there's a rhetorical delusion sometimes with Obama where he thinks that by the simple gifts of his capacity for political conciliation that he can somehow bridge all outlooks on the world. He sees himself as a conciliatory pragmatist, but sometimes that language breaks out down into mush. I think if you go issue by issue, the picture begins to emerge more clearly. I think in some sense the right is correct when they criticize him for not believing in American exceptionalism. And I think what that is, let's set aside the rhetoric for a second, that American exceptionalism in some ways is in some ways a delusion in the world. I mean, we are not going to remain forever the singular world power in military terms, in terms of cultural reach, in terms of certainly not in terms of economics. In fact, we're facing an enormous, I think, ideological threat that doesn't get talked about quite enough. If you look at two huge powers, China and Russia, China and Russia are now threatening our notion of our notion that democracy and capitalism go hand in hand. And what the Chinese threat is essentially saying that we can have capitalism and enormous growth and development and forego political democratization. And that, to me, is a huge debate that is, you know, not at the center of our discussions much at all. When it comes to other issues, so take the situation in Palestine and Israel and the greater Middle East, clearly Obama wants to get that settled, despite all the barriers to that, whether it's the domestic political scene in Israel or the divide among the Palestinians or the fecklessness of many of the Arab governments. But he is really eager to get movement there. Look, he faces a range of crises, and no one can possibly envy it. But I don't see him as a foreign policy ideologue.
Hmm. Thank you, Scott, for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking with David Remnick this hour of the program. His book just released, The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. 800-486-8655 is the number on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Remnick, our guest, 800-486-8655 is our number. And we go next to Steve from Oshkosh. Hi, Steve.
Good morning. Thanks. Mr. Remnick, I wonder if you could comment. It seemed to me in the first year of the administration, and especially the health care debate, I had the sense that the president had not had spent too much time in polite society. I mean, elite schools and Harvard Law School and a law firm filled with keen intellects and civil discourse. I had the feeling that he didn't know that John Boehner, for example, is not really a serious person when he talks about fixing things or making things better in America, that that Barack Obama just hadn't spent time with guys like Rush Limbaugh ever. Can you comment?
Well, the realities of politics are maybe tougher than the poetry of campaigning. And he was not a senator for a very long time. But he had experience of getting whacked around. In fact, the first real rhetorical political battle he had in the U.S. Senate, he got into a fight with none other than John McCain. And then they exchanged some nasty notes. McCain's was infinitely nastier than Obama's in that case. So I don't think he's a naive. When he was in the state Senate in Illinois, in Springfield, he practically got into a fist fight in the foyer with Ricky Hendon, one of his rivals in the Democratic Party. I don't think he, you know, lives in entirely in a bubble. I think that would be unfair. But there's no, I think it's probably impossible for anyone to imagine what it's like to be president and be at the kind of epicenter of all of this, of the politics and the media and the rivalries and all the pressures. I mean, it's just probably inconceivable for the rest of us to fully grasp it. So, in a sense, therefore, all of us are naive about being president.
It must be quite a job, David, huh? I mean, just the amount of time you're on planes and you don't sleep very much and you're dealing with these huge
issues. Well, I think he has a good plane. Probably a better plane than the rest of us have.
He better have, yeah. All right, let's go next to Don from Portage. Hi, Don.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I'd like to ask what the source of the money was for it attend these prestigious schools that Obama attended, particularly in his early years.
I think he got some financial aid along the way. Mm. And as a young man, when he got out of law school, he had accumulated some debts that were, you know, pretty tough. And both he and Michelle, who also doesn't come from a wealthy family, so they had serious, you know, loans to pay off. And it really isn't until Obama signs a book contract for a second, third, and fourth book that he becomes financially secure.
And early on, his grandparents paid for that Hawaiian school, didn't they?
Partly, and it's quite probable that he got some help, too.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Gary from Fitchburg, hi.
Hi. I was a Hillary supporter, and I've been watching politics for many, many years, and when I saw the little pity-pat treatment that Obama was getting, I was concerned that the elite was giving us someone that would serve their needs. And so I think Obama was a Trojan horse. I think he talked like he was from the left, but he's in there, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but he's like the Black Bush, you know. I mean, he's ramped up military spending in Afghanistan. He's not done much about a lot of the unconstitutional laws that Bush passed. And
I think in respect, though, I think that Hillary Clinton, when it comes to issues of national defense, would have been I don't think she would have been to the left of Barack Obama. If anything, her campaign was out to show that she was, you know, that she was tougher than he was. So, I respect your opinion about how you feel about those issues, but I'm a little unsure that that Hillary would have outflanked him on the left there.
Let's talk about some of the people around him. David Axelrod, obviously a very trusted advisor, very close friend. Dick Durbin also. Who are the four most important people in his life, outside family?
Outside family. Well, he's got Chicago friends. We've all come to know the names, people like Eric Whitaker, John Rogers, and so on. Valerie Jarrett is somebody that bridges the role of a friend, an old Chicago mentor, with somebody who's, you know, just upstairs from him in the White House. I think she plays the role in the White House of both trusted friend, you know, old friend, which is an irreplaceable thing once you get to that political atmosphere, and also somebody who's
dealing with issues having to do with mayors and more local outreach and race. I think she's very important to him to talk about those issues when they come up, although I don't think they look to have them come up publicly very frequently.
Mm-hmm. David, thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book. It's just it's a fascinating book.
A total pleasure.
Thanks. David Remnick, the book is The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. It has just been published. David, of course, the editor of The New Yorker. He's the author of King of the World, a biography of Muhammad Ali, selected by Time as the top nonfiction book of 1998. Also author of Lenin's Tomb, The Last Days of the Soviet Empire, for which he won the Pulitzer Prize in 1994. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. A reminder that tomorrow during this hour, John Yoo will be with us. His book is Crisis and Command. He was Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice from 2001 to 2003, and is a somewhat controversial man. We'll talk with him tomorrow. Thanks for listening, everybody. Great conversation ahead.